Paul Hansen. Each conference, I've always wanted to have someone who is of international stature in biblical studies. And you may remember some past participants that we've had, Walter Brueggemann, C.K. Barrett, Hans Walter Wolff, Calvin Retzel. I was trying to think if I covered them all. What? Well, yes. I was thinking biblically right now. Okay. He'd worked with the Bible once in a while, too, but sure. Preach from a few texts, you know, too. Okay. But I was thinking particularly of those in biblical studies. And I'm pleased that we are again able to entice someone of equal reputation to be with us for this conference. And one who's worked both academically and in the church, I think, has been a marvelous model for us. His background is Augustana Lutheran Church, a graduate of Gustavus Adolphus College. After a year in Heidelberg, he graduated from Yale with a B.D., and then a Harvard Ph.D. in 1970. Though he's an active Lutheran lay person, he has chosen not to be ordained. His scholarly work has earned him many prestigious fellowships, Fulbright, Woodrow Wilson, Danforth, among others. He is recognized around the world as at the cutting edge of biblical studies. Throughout his career, he's been a prolific writer. Apart from dozens of articles and series of constant lecturing, he's probably best known by us for several books: The Dawn of Apocalyptic, wrote in 75, or Dynamic Transcendence in 78, The Diversity of Scripture in 82, and then the one that I think more of you, at least, I'm sure, have read, The People Called, The Growth of Community in the Bible. If you haven't read it, I really recommend it strongly to you. He's an active Lutheran church leader, an advisory member of the ELCA Commission on Church and Society, active member of his local congregation. He's been teaching at Harvard throughout his whole career. I guess if you graduate from there and do well, they'd sort of keep you on. But that's where he's remained, even though I know he's been enticed elsewhere. His topic this week I find especially intriguing, on biblical faith and the public realm. He's concerned with the religious and ethical values in the naked public square, as it's been called. It will help us gain a biblical and Lutheran perspective. And today he's going to talk about current cultural malaise and the rediscovery of covenant. I want you to welcome the distinguished professor of in the Old Testament school at Harvard, Paul Hansen.
Olaf's come lately. And we're going to notice that they came with some very interesting tools, which apparently they haven't taken out of the tool sack yet. A high view of Scripture, a very clearly articulated Trinitarian and Christological theology, and an intriguing concept called the two-kingdom theory or teaching. Of course, those that dominated the stage in this country were those Calvinists. And I grew up with them intellectually and academically, and I have learned a lot from them. They came applying their Geneva model and have tried very, very hard, at least over the first century of our history, to impose that model on a not too cooperating society. I feel myself that it's time that we re-examine the way in which biblical sources were used by that particular movement, and then ask what we might have to say, not just critically, of this theodicy approach to society building, but what we as Lutherans have to contribute positively. In this, and here's where my fear and trepidation comes in, I, though a mere lay person myself, feel as one of my deepest convictions that clergy play a darn important part in a social setting that is extremely troubling. That's not just because of some lofty calling. It's because of historical destiny. This country has made a place for religion. And for better or for worse, whether we like it or not, clergy must play an important role in social change and in building a strong moral foundation in the face of some crumbling stones. So I invite you with me to look at this question of the contribution of the Lutheran heritage to building a stronger society, to join me in trying to clarify how our theology might function in that task and what political strategies we might tease out of it that would be faithful to our Lutheran heritage. To begin with, and that was my introduction, that's why I didn't go through what would have been the proper protocol of acknowledging the very worthy people in this audience today. Pardon me if I just jumped right in, but I'm just a country kid from Upper Michigan and I never did learn proper manners. After those preliminary words, I would first of all like to look just briefly, and I don't want to make this the typical not to do it that way sermon of listing ills for 20 minutes and then having 2 minutes of gospel. But I do want to, kind of as background for the three lectures, which hopefully will primarily be positive probes, look at the setting that we are dealing with, this culture that is bothering many of us right now. Sociologists tell us, and I think this is a basic truism really, that there are two prerequisites for a viable society, something that will just not sink, that will provide a structure of life for its people. One is what they popularly call a myth, or we could say an epic within our biblical and even American tradition, a myth or an epic that unifies the vision of a people around a common goal or purpose. Some story, some map of the universe that allows people to talk the same language and move in the same direction. Without that, there will just be a scattering of energies and no forward movement, and a civilization will cease. And we've seen plenty of examples of that. Christopher F. Mooney, in a recent and very interesting book in which he analyzes the legal profession in this country called Public Virtue, has written, "Every society is constituted by what Robert McElver has called a firmament of law, which represents to the world that particular order that constitutes the life center of the people." Firmament of law. Something that explains to the people in the community what their agenda is, and something that tells to the world what this particular society is trying to do. In addition to that prerequisite of a unifying myth or epic, equally important and growing out of it are effective institutions for inculcating the values that are inherent in that myth or epic. Institutions like the family, educational systems, and a stable and just government to maintain a context of order within which virtue and social stability can flourish. So an epic with its values and institutions to inculcate those values. Our country is a very interesting example of those two prerequisites being developed in a very early and vital manner. John Winthrop, already on the Arbella, preached the famous sermon, City Upon a Hill, of course drawing on a biblical metaphor, and developing what became the myth of early United States, the myth of the New Israel. Governor William Winthrop developed this myth very eloquently. He said, "May not and ought not the children of these fathers rightly say, Our fathers were Englishmen which came over this great ocean and were ready to perish in this wilderness, but they cried unto the Lord, and the Lord heard their voice and looked on their adversity. Now the parallel is too striking to be missed. A wandering Armenian was my father, etc. A clear allusion to early Israel's experience of moving out of Egypt, across the wilderness, and into a new land of manifest destiny. We can observe, therefore, at the earliest period of our national story, we developed an epic. We had our pilgrim ancestors, our patriarchs and matriarchs. We had George Washington, our Moses, and the Constitution, our charter or Ten Commandments. A foundation early on then had been laid, and the founders looked back upon it with a certain sense of pride and confidence. In a September 15, 1813 letter, Thomas Jefferson replied to an earlier letter of John Adams. He reflected, "We acted in perfect harmony through a long and perilous contest for our liberty and independence. A constitution has been acquired, which, though neither of us thinks perfect, yet both consider as competent to render our fellow citizens the happiest and the securest on whom the sun has ever shone. If we do not think exactly alike as to all its imperfections, it matters little to our country, which, after devoting to it long lives of disinterested labor, we have delivered over to our successors in life who will be able to take care of it and of themselves." We find in this early history the development of the epic and the moral foundation of our society that the American clergy played an extremely important role. They were a very small group, and they represented a much smaller minority. Estimates are that about 10% of those early colonists, and in the first generation of our Constitution, there were about 10% that were actual active church members. But nevertheless, about 50% of the worthies that are quoted in our early colonial period, reflecting on the political development of our country, 50% were clergy. Lyman Beecher in the 1830s looked back upon this and challenged the clergy of his time to carry on a tradition. He called for pious, intelligent, enterprising ministers throughout the nation, people who could establish educational centers. Harvard University, as you know, or the college was founded to train ministers, and this is what he had in mind. Establish educational centers, develop common habits and institutions of homogeneous influence. He went on to argue such would produce a sameness of views and feelings and interests and would lay the foundation of our empire upon a rock. End quote. You can see here a very close collusion between those interested in laying a legal social foundation and those developing a theocracy in this land. The theocratic model of early Israel was adopted by these divines as the basis for a new society. It was a model with tremendous staying power, certainly vital as a beacon and guide for at least the first century of our nation's history, and one that we must scrutinize with a great deal of care. However, the perspective of history has allowed us to see that the results of that American experiment, that taking of a biblical model and making it the foundation for an empire, brought with it a very mixed legacy. We mustn't downplay the positive. This was a nation that has given refuge to countless outcasts from across the world. It built ideals and values and individual rights into its constitution, and it made room for religious groups to continue to contribute to its unfolding. And thereby, it built a basis, a moral basis, for a charter allowing the development of a mighty empire. Now, what I want to do, though, is take special note of the negative legacy. And it'll take a few minutes longer, not because I am arguing that it is more negative than positive, but because it is this side to which we must attend. We have experienced an incredible expansion in wealth and power at the cost of some people who, if we had been true to our calling, would have been full citizens from the start. I think we don't need reminders of who those lost citizens are, but I think we must be shocked into realizing what we have done. Shocked so as to strengthen our moral fiber as we look to the future. In 1782, a Pennsylvania jurist, Henry Hugh Brackenridge, commented on the Native Americans, those to whom this land rightfully belongs, and called for, quote, extermination of the animals vulgarly called Indians. William Henry Harrison, governor of the Colorado Territory in 1870, as late as that, proclaimed, God gave us the earth and the fullness thereof. I do not believe in donating to these indolent savages the best portion of my territory. And Theodore Roosevelt, in what I suppose he thought was a humorous vein, said, I don't go so far as to think that the only good Indians are the dead Indians, but I believe 9 out of 10 are, and I shouldn't inquire too far into the case of the 10th. So we have the legacy of that whole lost race pushed further and further into the corner. And then there are the black Americans. A Harvard debating team member in 1773 apparently shocked no one into moral indignation when he defended slavery with the assertion that the black was, quote, a conglomerate of child, idiot, and madman. Most churches sadly lent their support to the slaveholders by arguing, as did the Bishop of London, in an influential pronouncement in 1727, that Christianity did not make the least alteration in civil property. It brought blacks freedom from bondage of sin and Satan. But going on with his proclamation, as to their outward condition, they remained as before, even after baptism. Now, this whole thing, of course, raged over the question of whether to baptize blacks, and the fear was that by baptizing blacks, they would be made full humans. And of course, slaveholders feared the results of that. And so here was a nice and early compromise. Blacks would be baptized so as to save their soul. But as far as property rights were concerned, nothing changed. Well, there were other dissenters, but we won't go on. The Puritan Congregationalists looked at Baptists, Quakers, and witches, and in order to establish their theocratic ideal, dissent had to go. Very important, of course, for us in a theological setting is the question of what the relation between church and state was during this very, very mixed history. We have noted the complicity of the early church groups with oppressive structures of slavery and repression of dissent. But in broaching the important subject of the relation between church and state in our country's history, it becomes very important to distinguish between what happened, the actual course of action taken, and the structures developed constitutionally. To blame all the ill that has happened on defects in the structure of our political system is to come off too easily as leaders of the church. Oh, our political system is imperfect, Doesn't take Luther, I think, to remind us of that, though he certainly does more clearly than any other reformer that I've ever found. But we know that this is a human institution. It is the product of fear, of sin, and hence we should not look here for a utopia. But nevertheless, it has been subjected to a lot of criticism over a long period of time. And it seems that it is about as hospitable for the development of a just and caring society as any system that has ever been developed in the human saga. And that can be illustrated, I think, most pertinently by looking at the First Amendment, a very short statement that doesn't just give passive acknowledgement of religious institutions, but as we can see by a whole series of Supreme Court decisions down to the present, encourages, behooves churches and religious establishments and institutions to be actively involved in the forming of a strong government and society. Even as lately as the Bowen versus Kendrick decision, allowing federal funding of church-sponsored sex counseling clinics, we can see that this is a government that encourages the religious sector to be involved. So we have a structure that I think, when we look at church-state relations, is a very helpful one. Protects us against the abuse of government by religious groups, but at the same time encourages churches and synagogues and mosques to get involved to help to discover a stronger society. The roots of that particular ideal of government are clearly articulated by many commentators. The Republican tradition stemming from ancient Greece and Rome, and then, yes, the biblical tradition, a tradition that's our responsibility and hence one that we must look at with greater attention. And that is one of the things we shall do in the three lectures ahead of us. We want to ask, first of all, with regard to those early Puritans, giving such prominence to the theocratic ideal and having noted some of the results of that theocratic approach, was that application of a new test of an Old Testament period or metaphor or model, was it legitimate? Is there a defense to be given for this particular development in our early history? And secondly, whatever we say about that, is there any remaining role that the Bible has to play within our social setting, within what has become a secular nation? Before we can do this, however, I think we have to make one more observation about that setting, about our culture, because it is not the country that our Puritan ancestors were developing. We witness what I called in the title of this lecture a cultural malaise, an anomie, a kind of a directionlessness. A lack of a clear sense of what we're building on anymore as a culture, what our traditions are. There are early cracks that could be perceived in this consensus, this theocratic approach to country nation building. Denominationalism early on began to shake the confidence of the leaders of this country and its religious supporters. What about this breakup into not just recognizable mainstream Protestant denominations, but the influx of Catholics, and then those new religions, Mormonism especially? Then, of course, the crisis of North-South. Was this indeed two nations after all? We find, in addition, the intelligentsia of this country returning to the old country, where there was a myth that they could use for their activities, for their novels and their poems and their myths and epics. James Fenimore Cooper already, and Samuel Clemens, Henry James, Robert Frost, Ezra Pound, T.S. Eliot, James Baldwin, the last to say, I am not supported by a crumbling society. So what we have witnessed is a breakdown of an American consensus. A national epic becomes fractured into ethnic and regional fragments. No longer George Washington and his gallant heroes. Instead, we get Prairie Home Companion, which may satisfy a few of us, but it's not enough upon which to build a country. Some poets have called for something equivalent to Wagner's Gesamtkunstwerk, that marvelous myth drawing deeply on the Germanic soul. But as many of us realize, so terribly, terribly dangerous, perhaps even demonic. But nevertheless, in the place of unity, we witness fragmentation, and it makes it difficult to go on building a strong society. This is seen in all areas of culture. In education, Stephen Toulmin has commented, from the early 17th century on, and increasingly so as the centuries passed, the tasks of scientific inquiry were progressively divided up between separate and distinct disciplines. As a result, the broad and general questions about cosmic interrelatedness, which were the focus of the earlier debates about nature, have been superseded by other more specialized disciplinary concerns. In its actual content, the science of the 19th centuries has become an aggregate rather than an integration of results from its component disciplines. Now, that's a scientist finding that he is unable to conduct his experiments anymore because each scientist is in a lonely laboratory somewhere, and the frontiers are no longer clear. We can see this in some of the major areas like cancer and AIDS, where we are lacking that kind of a total effort to conquer new realms. We look at the moon conquest and Voyager with nostalgia, and we long for some integrative experience that will move us forward as a people to conquer some of the enemies of civilization. But where those conquests are most needed, in education, in ethics, we find this fragmentation. Look at the abortion debate. There are two sides. This is a complex issue, but our solution is to divide up into camps, to fragment, not to move forward, or euthanasia, or censorship, at the same time as we create a vacuum that is a paradise for the leeches, for the demagogues of our society. And religion? Well, now the buzzword is pluralism. And we seem to celebrate that. Harvard Divinity School is now a temple of pluralism. But it's impossible either to have a worship service or to conduct a meaningful class in theology, because we are fragmented, going far beyond the denominationalism, going far beyond conversation between Christianity and Judaism. Now you have to make room for Satanism, scientism, anything that may come your way. Well, some people have taken heart in what they see as signs of the emergence of a new American myth. But I don't know how many of you here, with your background in a biblical communalism, are very much comforted by the nature of that myth. It's usually not given a bald designation, but I think if we call it what it is, it's self-serving individualism. The danger there is to now go on a bandwagon and condemn individualism per se, which, however, is in no way diametrically opposed either to a biblical tradition or a republican one. It was a certain type of individualism that allowed Israel's prophets to stand up against kings and nobles. It was a rugged individualism that allowed some of our reformers to stand up against medieval feudal lords and to start to develop a concept of individual human rights. Luther was an individualist who tackled the corruption of the church. The individualism of our founding ancestors gave them courage to stand up against an empire. Such individualism, though, is to be distinguished from what we see developing now, because it had a strong sense of civil responsibility. It's an individualism that regarded contributing to the common weal as the fruits of being a strong individual. We see a different kind of individualism growing, an opportunistic type in which individuals seek personal advancement in isolation of community, in disdain of the neighbor. Robert Bella has been prophetic in analyzing this with the bedroom community. To hell with the inner city, go there, get your wages, and then go back and be comfortable with those that are like you. Churches become affinity groups, very much akin to the country clubs, because they sort out the undesirables and the other thinking from the like-minded. Our colleges and universities are filled with this kind of individual. Oh, the helping professions. Yes, the mad rush into medicine and into law, but they're going there, these yuppies, to help. Yes, to help themselves. This is an acommunal individualism, and it is slowly permeating our social and our political system in this country. And we have now a new mythology and a value system developing out of it. We have a wonderful explanation being given for poverty, individual laziness, because this is a land of equal opportunity. The poor are lazy, and hence an excuse to cut back on public funding of education, health, and social welfare. A bitter, cynical kind of Darwinianism is characterizing our approach to these social problems. And when it comes to the success side, those that are making it in a very wild jungle world, we have developing an eloquent defense of an ideology of special privilege, which is a defense of a laissez-faire economic system. Among the victims of this new self-serving individualism are minorities, third world countries, and now our total ecological environment. I don't know where we're going. Some would comment on this development of a new individualism by saying that this is finally the result of an enlightenment coming to its full circle. We are coming of age as a people. This is the version of post-Christian secularism that is searching for new myths and new models and new symbols. Scratch the cross, the Bible, God. It's a brave new world, and we've got to invent a new mythology. What I see coming of this, however, is not a reliable new world. I see a moral vacuum, which is being exploited in the media, in business, and in private spheres by those that have their myth very much intact. And we have brand new empires growing, multi-international empires, which do have a very strident movement forward. As far as our mythology is concerned, we've created a vacuum. And religiously, we've encouraged the growth of degrading cults, and more close to the mainstream, we have opened the entire religious America to a growing fundamentalism, to which people understandably are fleeing because people need a mythology. They need an epic. They need a value system. And there they are finding answers, security of absolute authoritative answers. And so there it is. Too long. I knew I would get caught in the trap. That's our contemporary context. Cultural fragmentation, self-serving individualism, and ideological secularism. Together, these phenomena have set in motion a centrifugal force inimical to a unifying myth, capable of supporting a firmament of law for a society. And it's interesting to me that it's the sociologists that are telling us this. I don't see too much comment among theologians or Christian ethicists. The sociologists see that we no longer can sustain a culture, a civilization, with this kind of centrifugal tragedy. Are we now to announce the death of religion? Is this really what is happening in this country? Again, it seems to me that the growth of conservative denominations cautions us against this conclusion. What I think we are facing instead is, in what used to be the mainstream of religious America, there is a terrible state of confusion. The social sciences, as I have said, have shed light on this, some light anyway. We have the ethnic and religious mix which was supposed to lead to a melting pot, which has in fact led to an aggregate of conflicting worldviews. We have seen that the Enlightenment has come to sweep over many of our denominations, leading to a heartless, unspiritual rationalism. And finally, we see that we have come into an acceleration of progress called culture shock, which our religious communities are unable to address creatively. More significant, though, in my mind, than this kind of social scientific analysis is the reintroduction of some theological methodology, some assessment based on perhaps Paul Tillich's concept of ultimate concern. What is wrong with our society? Why can we be victimized by drug barons? Why can we not contain crime in our urban centers? Why in Tacoma do we have riots breaking out because we have huge pockets of poverty alongside of affluence? It seems to me that a theological critique goes far further than a social scientific one. I think what this yields is a society which has lost sight of principles and primary goals. I think we find a society that is scattering its energies over many, many false gods. I think fragmentation is a concept which can be enlightening. But if we are fragmented, and if we admit that, and if we see this as a product of sin, what can a biblically based Lutheran faith say to it? Can we help a society rediscover a center to rebuild a moral foundation? Well, I want to do two more things this afternoon. And one is to look at that model that our Puritan ancestors used to see whether we have something that can be repristinated there and put back to use to build that moral foundation. And then secondly, I want to point in what I think is a more promising direction. Our biblical beginnings meaningfully furnished for the Puritans a way of dealing with a new challenge. We can see that more clearly than ever in a more up-to-date reading of the Exodus account. It did not involve the movement of pristine ethical monotheists into a decadent Canaan which they conquered for God. Our Puritan fathers and mothers were satisfied with that model. What we see is a picture much more descriptive of the world that we are familiar with, a fragmented world. Deuteronomy 32, 8-9 is very interesting in that it describes, even theologically, the world that the Hebrews perceived. When Elyon gave to the nations their inheritance, when he separated the humans on the earth, he fixed the bounds of the peoples according to the number of the sons of God. Yahweh's portion is God's people. Jacob is Yahweh's allotted heritage. On the realm of the heavens, the Hebrews faced fragmentation. The God who led them was not the high God. The high God was Elyon, a god we know from the Canaanite pantheon as the father of the gods. Each of the nations had its god. The Canaanites had Baal, the Egyptians had Amun-Re, Israel had Yahweh, and so on and so forth. Fragmentation. The Hebrews were not this pristine nomadic class conquering a decadent culture with their concept of God all in place. The Hebrews were the Amorites sweeping down into Mesopotamia already in the year 2000. Others of them coming down into Palestine, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They were the people who were led into Egypt by the Hyksos, the Mitannis, who were a great and warring people who were able to destroy the Egyptian Empire for a time, taking some of these wandering Semites with them. And then finally, the Hebrews were the Apiru, or the Habiru, these listless, classless, dust-trotting people without a nation, without a land, falling at the interstices of the great empires of the time. Fragmentation was the beginning of the epic of Israel. But what brought a people out of this was not some answer from heaven, you shall be a blessing to the world in the sense of having special privilege, of having God provide all of your answers for you. What brought this people together was the discovery of a moral foundation, a center to the universe, something that gave them purpose. What they found was a God, Yahweh, who delivered them out of Egypt. That is an interesting catalyst. And it has been interpreted in different ways. Those that try to destroy all validity to the early Puritan experiment point out that even already in biblical times, this was simply an example of raw nationalism. The Egyptians had their Amun-Re, Israel had its Yahweh. The two of them battled, and the national God of Israel won. And from that time forth, Israel went forth into the world with their genie in a pot, ready to pull Yahweh out whenever they had to destroy an empire. If that's the case, then the absolute condemnation of our American beginnings is a proper one. That's a degrading kind of God. And that is a biblical tradition that probably isn't worth the paper that it's written on. Unfortunately, much of that early interpretation came with this austere people out of the wilderness destroying the Canaanites. And that's part of the negative side of our legacy. But if we look back in the eyes of archaeology and biblical scholarship at what happened among those Hebrews, we see that fragmentation, and we see Yahweh, God of Israel, entering that, not as a nationalistic patron deity, but as a fierce moral principle. Because in the Torah, in the prophets, in Psalm 82, we find that this was a God who did not defend a nation, whatever it did, but defended the oppressed, the poor, the widow, and the orphan. What we need to derive from our biblical beginnings, then, is not a model of nationalistic triumphalism, but rather a paradigm of a people who were able to become a nation because they became an alternative to oppression. I don't think that we can emerge from the Bible with a blueprint for a theocratic repristination of this country. It just doesn't work. But what we can gain more modestly is that if a nation, if a people is to be a strong people, it must discover a moral center, a moral purpose that specifically transcends nationalism and self-interest. And if it's going to invoke a God, it better be careful that it invoked that God morally and not for self-serving purposes. To come to a conclusion for today's thoughts, what we would notice then is that when we look back at our Puritan past, we've got to be very critical in the nature of our reappropriation. We must be careful to guard against sentimentalizing that period. New England Puritanism took a biblical model, but it used it to repress opposition. It used it to lay the groundwork for a kind of an imperialism that excluded the Native American, gave second status citizenship to the black, and became a bane to many other nations of the world. I think we must be very unsentimental in our reappropriation and critical, especially Because that growing fundamentalism that I referred to is appealing specifically to this theocratic model. Really, what, after all, is the moral majority, as Jerry Falwell, is Pat Robertson saying? Let's get back to that proud nation, this country, Christian, repressing opposition, and clear in its conquest of the world. That model, if it were to be reimposed, and it's really quite frightening to see how far a Pat Robertson can go politically in this country, or what kind of monies Jerry Falwell can raise for any cause in 24 hours in the figures of the millions. Even if that model could be reimposed, I think we must realize that it would be at the cost of a repression that would make Tiananmen Square look like kid stuff. But I think far more important than that kind of question of whether to a Christian Puritan America as a way of rebuilding our moral foundation. Far more important than that reservation are two questions. First of all, from a biblical and theological perspective, can we defend the Exodus as a warrant for re-Christianizing America? Is that the calling of the church, to use the Exodus or any other biblical warrant to try to reestablish a Christian empire called the United States of America? It's a hard question, but it's the first one I think we must raise. And the second question is this: if that model is not sufficient, then can we find any guidance in our biblical tradition for the relation between the church and the state? Now, in the following lectures, I'm going to suggest three things. The first is this. In the early Israelite Exodus experience, what we find is not a model for rebuilding a strong moral America, but what we find is a model for rebuilding a strong church. Secondly, if we are to look for a model or a paradigm for the way in which we as Lutheran churches can relate to politics and the larger society, we find it sooner not in the Exodus paradigm, but in the prophetic period and in the apostolic era. It's a far more complex model. It's intellectually far more demanding. It is far less satisfying to people who want absolute answers. But tomorrow we'll look more closely at what that model might be. And then in the third lecture, on a far more upbeat note, you thought you were the only ones that didn't sleep last night, right? But I think I'm going to make it, because this is my last point. In the last lecture, what I'd like to try to do, and this will get very experimental, is to bring together the best of what we have available to us as Lutherans in biblical scholarship with our Lutheran theological heritage, to see whether with that Exodus paradigm as a model for renewing the church, which I will argue is totally in harmony with Jesus' teaching of the kingdom, we're going to really do some magic tricks up here, whether that biblical tradition combined with what I find increasingly, I guess the more I teach in non-Lutheran context, the more I realize that, combined with our Lutheran heritage of the two kingdoms theory, the Zweireichslehre, whether here we do not have some real magic in store for us, whether we don't have in our biblical heritage a tremendous resource for renewing the vitality of our church life. And secondly, in our biblical and then Lutheran heritage whether we don't have a very intriguing model for making a genuine Lutheran contribution to political, social, cultural America. We'll see whether it works or not. Thanks a lot.